I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Well, hi, James. It is it's mid-March. The trade deadline is come and gone. We're looking ahead to the playoffs. What's going on?
Yeah, there's 16 games left in the Leaf season. Does it feel like that to you? Does it feel like it's gone fast or slow this year?
Both. You know, like after the trade deadline, it kind of slows down a little bit. Like, and I think the players probably feel that a bit too. And then like the last, you know how it goes, like the last 10 games, I think will feel like a flash, just because, or maybe they won't, because you and they and fans and everyone is kind of looking ahead to the playoffs. But I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on with the team right now that we're going to get into today, including how some of the new players, Joel Edmondson, Connor Dewar, Ilya Lyubushkin, how those guys are fitting in. I think we should talk about the goaltending. We should talk about the penalty kill. We should talk about the Bobby McMahon contract. Like, I was like, you and I were preparing for the show and thinking about things we wanted to talk about. And there's like a lot. Like we have a long list of stuff.
It's been a while, right?
We
haven't recorded in a while, so that stuff is piling up on us.
Yeah, so I think we should start today. I do want to talk about some of the injuries. In addition, we'll talk about Matthews. We'll talk about some of the stuff that they've been doing with the lines and the D. But I do think we should start with what's gone on for them late in some of these games. I wrote about this morning, so it's very top of mind for me. How concerning, like, do you think this actually is? Because I counted up, I went through all the games, and I found 9 instances where in the final 5 minutes of regulation, they gave up either the game tying goal or the go-ahead goal. And I just think ahead to the postseason, I think, like, you have to be able to lock down a lead or you're just going to get eliminated. Like, do you think it's a bad omen? Like, do you think it's just fluky? What do you make of this situation? Because obviously we saw it on Saturday when they played Carolina.
Yeah, and that was a bad one to blow against a really good team, and you're up 4-2, and yeah, that was ugly. This has been a problem for the Leafs for a long time, right? Like over the last few years, they've had some stretches where they've been able to do it and hold a lead and close out games, but it's one of those things that I think the fan base has gotten used to being part of their identity. And, you know, I part of it with this team is their personnel, right? Like there's one thing that's still really missing. And it's like, especially, you know, when Marner's out of the lineup, that hurts in this regard. But you're looking at who you want to have on the ice to close out the game. Yarncroc's another one too, right?
Yep.
You look down the bench at the blue line, who do you want out there to win the game for you when you've got a 1 or a 2 goal lead late? And it's not that there's not a no-brainer decision there for who you want out there. And, you know, it's one of the things that didn't really get addressed at the trade deadline. And maybe they would argue that they couldn't address at the trade deadline. And it's, you know, it should make the organization and the fans nervous going into the playoffs, because you just don't know if you're playing Boston and they've got Pasternak out there and there's a minute and a half left, who's going to be able to help shut him down? Or if you're playing Florida and it's Reinhardt and Barkov are out there, who's going to be able to close that out? And they don't have a great answer for that on this roster.
Yeah. And so you look back to last year and it's like they had Ryan O'Reilly and they had Noel Achary and they had some different options. Obviously Alex Kerfoot is a good defensive player. Justin Hall, Luke Shen. And I think you're right. Like I do think it is a personnel thing. Like you look at what happens after Aho scores the goal that puts Carolina within 1. And these are the 5 players they put on the ice: Bobby McMahon, John Tavares, William Nylander, Jake McCabe, TJ Brody. Now Brody and McCabe is their best defensive pairing, which is part of the issue. But like those forwards, like none of those guys are great defensive players, but who are you supposed to put out? Like there's just not a lot of people that I think if you're the coach, you're like, yeah, like that guy's just going to be able to salt the game away. Is there part of this? I was thinking afterward, after I wrote about this, like I was just thinking, like, is there any part of it? Like how much of it is coaching, or can you not, like, you know what I mean? Like, is there a part of that that's coaching? Or do you just think like when you just have this type of personnel, like that's just what's going to happen?
Well, it's gotten to the point for me that the part of it that's coaching is that I don't know how Sheldon Keefe can still think he can trust TJ Brody to be that guy. Like it's almost, reminds me of like, we've seen this so many times where a player, you know, gets older. And I think it can be hard for the coach to realize that this guy who you've relied on for, what's TJ Brody been here? 3 years?
This is
four. You've relied on for the previous three seasons, and he's been a rock for you, and you've been able to put him out there in a lot of tough situations and have him play well. This year, he's not that guy. He doesn't have it, you know? And, you know, sometimes as an older player, it can go relatively fast and you can fall off, and it's on the coaching staff to recognize that. So then again, I mean, you look at the personnel and it's like, I don't know. I mean, maybe they should try like Edmondson and McCabe or something like that at the end of the game, or maybe they need to try, I don't know, maybe the McCabe and Labushkin, you know, like Labushkin had some really bad turnovers in that game. It's not like he's not really a lockdown the last minute of a game type of player. So, you know, but I just think that Brody is playing so poorly right now that they need to move away from thinking he can be out there in those situations every time.
But see, you've hit on the problem. It's like, okay, so you don't want to put Brody out there. Who do you want to put out there? Like,
well, I said Edmondson.
Yeah, you said Edmondson. I guess like Edmondson was out there trying to kill the penalty that led to that the first Aho goal with
Labushkin. The question is like, is he better than Brody or not? I mean, that's the only question, right? And I think with the way Brody's playing right now, it's probably yes.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Like that feels like it's asking. Like we talked about Edmondson on the trade deadline podcast. Like he was the number six defenseman in Washington. Like now you're going to be playing him like in a shutdown kind of role like that. He's not like you've seen him well already. Like he gets, and we were going to talk about this later, but we can talk about it now, but he can get exposed with speed. Like you can see it. You can see the upside of him. He's so big and he's got such long reach, but he can
vulnerable. He blocks everything. He's in the lanes. Like it's not perfect, but they didn't add like a perfect solution. So, and I'm not saying play Edmondson against top lines the whole game necessarily, but maybe in the last minute and a half or whatever, and when you just want someone just to get in the way and clear the front of the net, maybe that's what you do.
Yeah, I don't hate that. You know, one thing, I mean, they like obviously the Riley Labushkin thing, that's a big part of why they got Labushkin in the first place, and I get that, and I think that pair has been pretty okay. I kind of want to see like Riley McCabe and see if that can be that can be your top pair, and then maybe that pushes Brody down and pushes Labushkin down. Like McCabe, like you've been talking him up all year. Like if he's that guy, and like is he their best defensive defender? Like I don't, like who's their best defensive defenseman at this point?
I think he's an all around. He's really calmed his game down a lot. And you know, early in the year and last year, he was kind of running all over the place and trying to do way too much. And I really like the way that he's played more recently.
Yeah. But you know what, like this gets to something that we've talked about a lot in the second half of seasons with Sheldon Keefe, especially maybe now is just the time to try some different stuff and see what sticks, because we were going to get to this later, but the Brody McCabe thing, like it's so important that it works. It really didn't work on Saturday. They were hammered. Anytime those guys were on the ice, I'm looking at the overall numbers for this season, which are like, I don't know what to make of them because it's been so sporadic that they play together, but 46% expected goals. Like it's not been great. And you're right. Like the Brody thing is a big problem. And that's why it felt so essential that they added someone. I don't know. Do you pair his minutes down? Like on Saturday, they basically just kind of rotated three pairs. Like they didn't even really match up in any specific way. They just kind of rolled three pairs, and maybe that's what they have to do. I don't know. So
I mean, his minutes are not that high now, really. Since they got Labushkin, I got 116 minutes over seven games. So how could your math? That's like, well, what, 16 minutes even strength a game?
Yeah, but I'm looking at the last 10 games. He's number one on the team in 5-on-5 ice time, just ahead of Riley. Yeah, and well ahead of McCabe.
But that's just, that was, I don't know about you, but that was one of my main takeaways from the Carolina game was Brody is going to struggle against top teams in those kind of situations. He's not a big guy, and he always really relied on his feet and quick thinking. And it seems like the feet have gone a little bit. And
you know what the other thing is? I'm glad you mentioned the quick thinking, because I think that is something that we underestimate with players getting older. Is your, what's the way to describe it? Like, you're not your decision making, but your quick twitch, I think, just gets a little slower. You know what I mean? Like, you just want to do something and it maybe takes you an extra half second to do it. I don't know if that makes sense, but it kind of feels like that's something that happens with older players where, like, I think we see it a little bit with John Tavares, where you're just like a little slower in getting stuff done, and it costs you. Like, I don't know. It's part of getting old. Obviously, a big part of that game and really the season that we should move on to is their penalty kill. It continues to be a problem, and it's hard. It's going to be hard to win in the playoffs if the penalty kill is not tight. And they're still, like, it's crazy that it's the middle of March and they still really don't know who are killing penalties for them. I don't know if that's just Brody or Marner and Yarncroft being out, or what, but it's a little alarming how much they don't really seem to know as to who can kill penalties for them.
That's part of it, right? That it's, that's part of the reason why it didn't look very good. I'm just looking up here. I mean, the correct me if I'm wrong, the penalty kill has been a problem in the playoffs, right? Like, I mean, last year it certainly was. I'm just like, I'm thinking in general, I think that that's been one of the stories for why they have struggled so much. Penalty kill 81% in the last four postseasons. I mean, special teams in general, like, the power play's fallen way off for them in the playoffs. And then the penalty kill's been, I would say, just okay, but it's certainly cost them some series.
Well, so, they had better penalty killers last year, and this is their penalty kill in the playoffs last year, 73% in 11 games, which is bad.
Right.
Obviously.
Right.
And their power play was 25%. So, like, if you had a decent penalty kill, and now they're facing Tampa, who has an amazing power play, and I'd have to pull up the numbers for that, but it's just really hard. Like, you saw that Carolina penalty kill on Saturday. They are incredible. They are just all over you. It's unbelievable how they kill penalties. And then, like, again, is it just personnel? Like, they really don't have a lot of experienced penalty killers.
Well, the Leafs went and hired the assistant coach who helped build that Carolina penalty kill. And remember, for the first, like, whatever, 40, 50 games that Dean Chenoweth was here, it felt like the penalty kill was fixed, but it's gone sideways.
But you remember, like, James, like, in last season, even the previous season, they were really dangerous on their penalty kill, like Kampf and Kerfoot and Marner. And obviously before that, like Mikheyev, like they, and Engvall, like they would kind of be almost as threatening sometimes as the power play. And they've just kind of lost that, like, they were kind of all over you. And now they just have a lot of guys where it's like, they don't totally look comfortable. Like, they tried Nylander, obviously, in a more prominent role with Marner out. That's like, it's okay. They're using McMahon. They're using Holmberg. Like, I think Connor Dewar can help, but it's like, I just think, like, game seven, they're on the road in Florida. Like, who are they going to feel comfortable putting out there for a penalty kill? It just doesn't feel like a very long list. And it's like, you know what I mean? Like, it's Marner, Kampf, Yarncroft, and I guess Nylander.
The new guys have to be part of the solution, right? But it's interesting, you know, if you look at, I don't know how closely you've looked at this, but you look at some of, like, those RAPM and analytic charts for Edmondson and Lyubushkin on the penalty kill, and the numbers aren't great. Like, they don't really seem to rate out as, like, high end PK guys, even though they're defensemen.
Those stats are tough. I guess the thing with both those guys, like, Edmondson is a little bit, I mean, their best penalty killer on defense in previous seasons was Hall, and he was just so big and long and he had a good stick. And like, even Giordano, like I thought it was a lot to ask him to be there on their first penalty kill, but like he blocks a ton of shots. Mm-hmm. He's super active. Like, I guess they're hoping with Labushkin and Edmondson that they can just kind of take up space. And suddenly that's your second penalty killing unit. But again, like your first unit is Brody and McCabe. And it's like, if Brody is this, yeah, I don't know. Like it's interesting because they have to find a way to make it work. And yet it's not working. Like they have one of the worst penalty kills in the league. And I look, James, like the only team with a worse penalty kill that's actually in the playoffs is Nashville. Like all the other teams below them are non-playoff teams. Like they're some of the worst teams in the league. So concerning. What, I would say.
What's the PK at for the season this year?
76.8%, I believe.
Right. So that's probably one of their lower numbers. And I can't remember them being that low in a long time. Like they were always really low on the penalty kill under,
yeah,
you know, the Wilson Carlisle era. They had a tough time on the penalty kill. So they're 24th in the league, and Nashville's behind them by like less than 1%. So they're almost the worst penalty killing team that's going to make the playoffs.
Yeah,
they have a worse penalty kill than Chicago, who are not trying to win.
But again, like, what are you supposed to do? Like you mentioned Chenault, like. Obviously, when he had the right people, when you have Slavin and you have Pesci and like you have like some of the penalty killers that they have up front in Carolina, and you have the personnel, like it's, I don't know, like I just don't know what you can do if you don't have the people out there.
I guess you gotta adapt to what your personnel, who they are, and what they can do. And again, I think it's a case of where Brody shouldn't be on the top penalty kill unit, and you got to try Edmondson or Labushkin there. My preference would be Edmondson.
Yeah, maybe that's what you do. Maybe you try Edmondson, McCabe, and then go Brody, Bushkin or something. Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the goaltending, and then we have a bunch more to get to. I want to talk about the injuries. Depth scoring actually has been a positive.
Leave some time for questions. Leave some time for questions.
That's on the list. Don't worry.
Put the call out for questions on a Sunday afternoon, and we got over 100 immediately.
Wow. Okay. Where are you at with the goaltending? It kind of feels like Samsonov is kind of taking this thing a little bit.
I really like the way Samsonov's playing. Like I think he's been really, really good.
So, do you think there's opportunity for Wall to make this a competition or
no? Well, I know the organization, they want to see Wall step up and grab it. But if Samsonov keeps playing this well, it's going to be difficult. You know, Wall's going to have to play really well in the starts that he gets. So, you know, it's interesting. You look at on the year and Wall's stats are a lot better than Samsonov just because of how bad Samsonov was early in the year. Yeah. And I would say, too, that, you know, Samsonov lets in 4 against Carolina, but he was good. Like, that speaks to where, in some ways, where the team's at defensively, that the goaltender can play that well and you're still giving up 4, which is not great.
The only thing I would say, and that I've been thinking about this, is I just don't think it'll be settled until, I don't even think it'll ever be settled, honestly. Like, I think this could change the whole way, like even in the playoffs, no matter how far they get, like it kind of feels like whoever it is going to be on such a short leash. You know what I mean? Like, just because Samsonov doesn't have, like, he's not, even if he plays well for the next 2 weeks, one, like, little stretch where he's just really rocky and it's back open. Like, he just doesn't have that credibility where you're like, he's the guy. But I agree with you. Like, he's turned it on. Like, I thought there was a stretch coming out of the All-Star break where it's like, uh-oh. And I think he's been better. They'll split the games this week, so Wall has an opportunity. But I would have to imagine, James, that they were probably disappointed with how it went for Wall in those 2 Boston games, where he just wasn't great. Like, he wasn't terrible. He just wasn't great. And obviously he's coming off like a really long absence. You wonder how difficult that is for him.
Yeah, I was a bit surprised they gave him both the Boston games. And I think that speaks to, they were hoping that he would grab it and play really well. It's a hard injury to come back from. He missed a lot of time. He's a young guy who hasn't played a lot in the NHL. It's going to take him a little bit of time. So I'm not writing Wall off. I'm just saying Samsonov's been really, really good. And that's such a positive sign. And realistically, if the Leafs are going to go deep and have a long run, you know, and some people might be laughing at that. Some cynical fans might be laughing at that comment, but if they're going to, they're going to probably going to need both guys. You know, we've seen lots of runs where teams, you know, two goalies get in the net at times, and that's probably where the Leafs are at.
Do you care at all that the guy with the best 5-on-5 numbers on the team is actually Martin Jones, or no? Don't care. By like a significant amount.
Not really. Okay. I mean, you start to get into some sample size issues with, I mean, how many games has Martin Jones started? 17 or something?
No, 20. He's played more games than Wall.
Yeah, he's very clearly number three. But I mean, the fact that he cleared waivers and he's still, and they have the cap space and he's still on the team, it's not out of the question that he could play in the playoffs as well if someone gets hurt.
Yeah, I might get him a game. If I were them, I might try to get him the odd game the rest of the way. Like maybe, I know
they could condition him and get him down in the Marlies.
Yeah,
They should do that for sure.
Yeah.
Because you don't want him, like, what's the last game that he played?
It's been a while, hasn't it? I mean, I guess it would have been just before. It's probably not as long as we think because Wall only just returned.
One of those road trips they mixed him in, right?
Yeah, it was the Vegas game, and he gave up 3 in that win. He was good, remember? That was February 22nd, so almost a month, actually.
Yeah.
So let's take a break, and then let's talk some injuries. Let's talk about, we should talk about the McMahon contract, and then we have a bunch of questions, like you mentioned, to get into.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Before we get into McMahon, and maybe we can talk a little bit about Matthews too, and just a little stretch for him. Mitch Marner out, Cale Yarncroc out. You can really feel it when you lose like two guys like that. Like Marner is obviously irreplaceable on this team. But Yarncroc, like you can really feel it. Like we mentioned the end of the game, we mentioned penalty kill. They're obviously being very vague about what his, like they said hand, they said week to week. A broken hand is like a month, if that's what it is. And Mitch Marner has a high ankle sprain. That's usually a month at least. There's like some talk that like there was some talk like he could have played Saturday. And it's like, what? Really? Like he hasn't even practiced with the team. But there's
different degrees to it. But yeah.
Sure. But so, yeah, like the timing is not great, especially... you know, Marner could be back any time now, but Yarncroc, like if he's coming back just before the playoffs, like that's not ideal. I guess the upside is like they get to kind of try some things, but you can really feel it on that top line. They just don't have anyone who really fits right now. Like Pontus Holmberg, they tried that. That doesn't really work. I would imagine we'll see Bobby McMahon there at some point. Again, that's not great. I don't know if you have any thoughts on these injuries.
Yeah, I mean, Sheldon Keefe likes to rely on that Matthews line to eat the tough matchups, and they've played pretty well in those situations for a lot of the year. And if all of a sudden you've got Holmberg out there and you're trying to use that against top lines, it puts you in a tough situation. And he was on in front of the net there on that one goal and wasn't able to contain the forward and in front of the net, and it's a goal against.
What do you make of this little Matthews stretch? I don't know if, like, I guess you call it a slump relative to him.
I've been having a lot of people ask me, does he have the flu that's been going around the dressing room? And to be honest, I didn't ask. I don't know, but he hasn't looked himself for a stretch of 5 or 6 games.
Yeah, in his last 10, he's got 3 goals and 3 assists, and the expected goals is like 51.5%, something like that. So
just hasn't been noticeable. Hasn't been taking over games, you know. So I don't know if that's fatigue. I don't know if there's an injury. Don't know if that's an illness.
He's just not skating with the same pop. Like when he's really rolling, like there just isn't that pop to him.
I've seen in past seasons, he gets worn down a little bit around this time of year. So
yes, I can tell you, like statistically, some of the numbers back that up, that March is kind of like a quieter month for him. Mm-hmm. And maybe honestly, maybe part of it is like just self-preservation. Like if I'm him, maybe I'm thinking like, man, like I got to make sure I have enough gas for the playoffs. Like I don't love if I'm him or I'm them that he's playing 24 minutes on Saturday. But again, like they're trying to win the game. They don't have a ton of other options. Like you take Marner out and that's like your 20 minute guy who you also have to replace. You don't want to play Nylander too much. They're not playing Tavares very much. I don't know.
I think they've got to be careful that Matthews isn't ground to dust by the time they get to the playoffs, right? Like they've basically clinched a playoff spot. Like they're, you know, they've got 85 points in 66 games. I think on our chart, their chances of making the playoffs are at 100% basically. They've basically clinched third. Clinched is probably the wrong word. Tampa's 7 points back of them. It would take a lot for Tampa to knock them out a third in the Atlantic. So they're locked in there pretty good. I think they need to be careful that Matthews' minutes don't go to, you know, 24 plus every night on the down the last 16 games here.
Yeah, and like over the last 10, he's around 21 minutes. And like if you look at even that, like you'd love to bring that down to like 20. I know it doesn't feel like a lot, but if you look at like Tampa, those years they were winning the cups, their top forwards didn't play 20 minutes. Like they were all like 18, 19 minutes a game. It's just like you have to be able to rely on different people. And they're doing some stuff with their lines the last couple games. Like I don't love all the shifting every game. Like if, you know, like Tavares is the second center one game with Domi on the wing, and then the next game Domi's back at center. Like I don't know.
He's searching for some things, right? And I think some of it's home and road too, don't you?
It
looks like they're using
matchups for sure.
Maybe you can just explain that briefly, like what they're doing at home and on the road. Like it seems like it's like a safer lineup on the road kind of thing.
Well, to your point, like so they had David Kampf playing the third line center position when they're on the road, which kind of insulates them. They can have kind of four lines, or at least like you'll have Matthews, Tavares, Kampf, Duer. And suddenly, like you've got four lines where you're not really totally worried, no matter who goes out there. Whereas if like Domi's out there, suddenly you're a little bit more vulnerable. However, they had Domi playing third center or second center for a big chunks, even when they were on the road. So it's not something they're like totally against, but it's just such a vulnerability when he's on the ice defensively, especially when he's playing with Nylander. Like that combination doesn't work. That's kind of what I would go back to. And yet, like the camp third line center thing, like we've talked about it before, like there are just limitations offensively with that. And that's why I thought it was essential that they get a center. They didn't get a center. And so now they're kind of in this weird box. I just don't know if I'd like it for Tavares. Like I kind of want to, if I'm them, I kind of want to keep building Tavares up. Now, Keith talked him up pretty highly after the game about how well he played. I just want him feeling good heading into the playoffs if I'm them.
Don't you think in the playoffs they might use different forward lineups for at home and on the road? It kind of feels like with what he's got and what he can trust that he feels like he can protect Domi at center at home and he can't on the road. So I wonder if they might go flip back and forth when the games, you know, when they're in the postseason, which would mean everybody's going to have to get used to the idea of not having stable line mates in the playoffs.
Yeah, I don't love that. Do you like that idea? Like, I just, can you move stuff around that constantly and like have any success? I mean, we've seen Keith do that kind of thing before. Like, you remember, it's not quite the same thing, but when, you know, Nylander would start games with Kampf and then you move up and play with Tavares, like they would just do kind of things like that. So
I suspect that's where we're headed here, I suspect.
All right. Before we get to questions, what did you think of the Bobby McMahon extension?
I like it. I love this guy as a story. Like he's just like, you know, the ultimate story of just hard work and continuing to push. You know, there's not that many players that have played in the ECHL that get an NHL contract, like just like the percentage wise, it's so small, you know, never drafted in the NHL. He wasn't drafted into the WHL, goes to college at 20 years old and not even like, he went to a decent college, but not like, and I don't think that they were expecting, I mean, you even look at his numbers when he's playing in the AJHL, like he's not a star there, you know, his 19, 20 year old season, he has a big year, but before that he was kind of a role player even down there. And he's a guy that's just built and just worked. You know, I went to, I take my kids to the Marlies sometimes and took them to some Marlies games last year, and McMahon really stood out. And what really stood out were three things. Size, he's a big guy. He can move better than you expect. Like, he really stood out at the AHL level for his skating, and he just works like a dog. Like, he works so hard. And he was a lot of fun and a difference maker in the AHL last year, and that's what got him to here. So it's been a pretty quick rise. Like, he wasn't in the organization. They must have signed him right out of college, right? I don't even have that in front of me. It's only been like the last 3 years. You know, he didn't get out of university until he was 24 years old, started in the ECHL, started on the fourth line with the Marlies and with the Growlers for a few games. And look at him now. You know, now he's got like almost half a point a game, and he's got a one-way NHL contract, and he's almost 28 years old. So good for him.
So I got to be honest, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more. I think, to me, it feels a little bit rushed.
There's no risk at all with this.
No, I agree with you. But if you minus like that 5-game stretch where he scored 7 goals, he's got like 3 goals in 36 games. You look the last 11 games, he's got 1 goal and I don't even, maybe 1 assist.
He's and not like, going to be a huge scorer.
No,
and, I mean, let me finish.
Like, I would just say, like, literally it was a month ago where he was about to be a healthy scratch again. Like, he had been getting scratched at that point. And prior to that St. Louis game, he was not supposed to play in that game. Like, he was just supposed to be out of the lineup, healthy scratch. And at that point it was like, what is this guy? Like he was playing 7-8 minutes a game. And now maybe something has changed for him. And he does look, I think, different since that stretch where he started scoring, but I just like to see a little bit more. And yet you're right. Like, there's not really a lot of risk. Like, he'll be third, fourth liner next year, but it's just like, if that 5-game stretch doesn't happen, I don't think the extension happens. And that feels a little bit like, well, I don't know. It feels a little reactionary to a little tiny sample where he scored a bunch. And then if you look at the first 25 games of the season, even the last 10, like, he's just, I don't know what he is, but for 1.35, it's like, it's fine.
Well, I'm looking at the last, since they brought in Labushkin, they played 7 games, and like, all of the defensive side of everything for McMahon is fantastic. And that matches the eye test. You know, he's at like 56% of the expected goals and 58% on scoring chances. And like, they've been playing him in tougher situations. So I think that salary, he got 1.35, you can bury almost the entire thing. It's a fourth liner's salary. You need him really just to be like a 10 to 13 goal guy and a penalty killer and an energy person on the fourth line. And I think that's what he is. You know, I think expecting him to be a 20 goal player is, unlikely. Now, that said, I mean, he's had in the AHL, he's put up some pretty good numbers. So,
yeah. And I mean, James, like, coming into the year, you and I were both high on him as like a fourth line, exactly what you're talking about. Big, strong, skates well. And it feels like he is rounding into that. Like, I don't want to, I liked him as a player. Like, I think there's lots to like. I just would like to see more. But
well, think of it this way, Jonas. Like, he's UFA, right? And with his size and skating, and if he puts up some numbers, I mean, he's got, like I said, he's got like half a point a game. Some team is going to sign him. And yeah,
giving him more than that? I don't know.
I was going to say, I think he could have got more. Like, some, you know, if you're a bad team, why wouldn't you take a flyer on a guy like that and see what he can do? You know who it kind of reminds me of, and not 100% the right comparison, but Mason Marchment is who it reminds me of. Like, remember people that like Mason Marchment, like big, slow. Yeah,
but he was younger. Like, he's 28 in June. Like, he's not, you know what I mean? Like,
age
you're
just,
buying his
age is just a number, Jonas. Yeah, but I mean, clearly McMahon's a guy who's a late bloomer. Like, clearly he's someone who's figured something out in his mid to late 20s. And sometimes those guys that go through, don't go through major junior, and then do the 4 years of college, sometimes you can see them come out the other side and it takes them a little bit of time. I mean, Zach Hyman is the perfect example.
Well, he's like the Uber example. But yeah, you're right. Like, and it does feel like something's flicked on with him, like confidence-wise, where he's like, now I kind of belong. And like I mentioned, they're using him on the penalty kill. Like, he's becoming, you can tell that Keefe is starting to trust him more. Like, he replaced Pontus Holmberg in the third period of that game on Saturday. I like him. Like, I think he's a good player. You're right. Like, it's a great story.
So just to continue my comparison, like, Mason Marchment was 24 when he broke out with the Marlies, and McMahon was 26 last year when he did. So Mason Marchment had that year before they traded him where he had 13 goals in 24 games in the AHL. They had him up with the Leafs briefly. He played four games, and it's like, well, he's big, but he seems slow, and I don't know. And then he goes to Florida and, you know, becomes an NHL player. And I think there's enough elements. Yeah, I don't think McMahon's going to be Marchment, but I think he's going to be an NHL player.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's reasonable. Yeah. I don't mind it.
If you wait and he scores a few more goals, the agent's probably like, let's just go to free agency because maybe we can get $2 million or something.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, okay. You want to move on to questions? I'm trying to think, is there anything else you want to hit? Do you want to talk a little bit about depth scoring? I mean, he's a big part of them finally getting depth scoring, but we can go to questions if you want to bypass that.
Yeah, I think some of the conversation that we're going to get into next is going to come up with the questions. The number one question people want us to answer is from Jake, and he says, my children are stealing my energy. Is there statistical evidence that suggests player performance drops after you have kids? It would make me feel like an athlete if there was. I've never seen anyone write about how NHL players perform before and after they have kids, but it's a very common fan theory. Like, I know when Tavares had his kids, it's like, oh, he's not playing well because he's got, you know, there's a baby at home. And I've never talked to NHL players about how they parent, but I would imagine that they hire help and that they're not, like, I don't think they're giving babies bottles at like 2 a.m, like the way that I was, you know, but maybe I'm wrong on that, but I would think to be a high performance athlete, you would have to be a little bit more hands off at times. So
I can tell you from talking to some of the players about this, that the biggest challenge for them is sleep. And like, you talk to them when they get on the road and they're like, slept so much more. It's such a good sleep, but they also miss their kids. Like, there's like,
like,
I mean,
you, like me on the road. Too.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you miss your kids, but like, you're also getting a deeper, better sleep. Like, it can't not be a factor, but that's like everybody who has kids, I'm sure, deals with that.
It's just like when you're on the pro level, and I think part of what people are seeing, I mean, the most of the players who have kids are older, and the NHL is just becoming younger, and it's becoming, you know, TJ Brody, 33 years old. He's almost 34. Like, that makes him one of the oldest players in the league. Like, that's old in the NHL now.
Yeah.
Which is depressing to say as someone into their 40s. Yeah. So I think I don't know. It'd be interesting. We should probably do a story about that. I feel like maybe we did at one point. I'd have to go back and look. Something about trying to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think someone did do a story, but like, not, I don't think it was a Leaf story. I think it was like an NHL story. I want to say Mark in Chicago wrote it at some point, but anyway, that's funny that that's the top question that I think a lot of our listeners are probably tired parents. So a shout out to them for powering through that and listening to our nonsense as a reprieve. Dexter wants to ask, what do we make of the Leafs' poor record against the Atlantic Division teams? He says they're 8-9-2. I didn't double check that, so we're going to take your numbers. Compare that against the West, where they're 23-6-2. It seems like the less frequently the Leafs play a team, the better they fare. Could this be an indictment of the coaching staff, et cetera, et cetera? What do you make of them not having a good record against the Atlantic? Does it mean anything?
I mean, I would struggle with this because the only teams like I would really care about are the teams that they might face, like Boston, Tampa, Florida. Obviously, mm-hmm. they've not played Boston well this year. They've played Boston well in the past, so they're 0-2-2 against Boston this year. Not great. Let's see. Florida has been... Florida's kind of felt like the better team, but they're 1-1-0. Obviously, they've got a couple games left against Florida, I believe. And then Tampa... What is Tampa? Let's see, James. Tampa, they're 2-0. So that's really all I care about. And even then, like, I don't know how much... stock you put, we talked about it before, like how much stock do you really put into those Boston games? Like, I don't know.
Well, I would say that, like, style, I mean, those are all good teams for one. So like your record's not going to be, it's going to be hard to put up a good record against them. And I just think stylistically, the Leafs have a hard time against, I mean, Carolina is a good example, but just, you know, the defensive ability and physicality of Florida and Boston are tough matches for the Leafs. You know, I think that they would, if they were playing the Oilers in a playoff series or, you know, a more wide open team, it would be better for the Leafs. But that's the division that they're in is not a division like that.
Yeah. I guess the only other thing that to this question's point that's problematic for them is they've just lost points that are costing them a chance to either win the division or be second in the division. Like, they lost 3 or 4 games against Ottawa. And if you look, like, and you're thinking, like, man, like they've been on this heater. They've won 16 of like 22 games, and they're barely catching second and first in the division. You can go back to like all those games they lost against Ottawa, or the games that they lost against Chicago, or the games that they lost against Montreal. Like, those hurt. And even like we mentioned, those late game situations, like I counted 9 games, and 5 of those they just lose in regulation. So you get 0 points. So there's 5 points.
They're way back of second in the division now.
Right.
That's like a pipe dream now. Like, they're 9 points back of Florida and 10 back of Boston. Like,
that's how it happens. Like, that's how you lose the chance to have home ice or to win the division. Like, that stuff, you can't kind of let that stuff happen if you want to have home ice or win the division.
John wants to know, he said, people seem to think after Saturday's game, the Leafs blow a lot of leads. That doesn't seem to be true because their record of leading after 2 periods is 28-3-3. How does this compare to the rest of the league? Do the other fan bases panic like this after 1 OT loss? Almost every team in the league has an amazing record when leading after 2 periods. What we've seen from the Leafs is not even necessarily leading after 2 periods, but sometimes in the 3rd period they have a lead. Were they leading after 2 periods against Carolina?
Yes.
Yeah.
I just mentioned it. Like, so I counted 9 times in the final 5 minutes of a play that they gave up the game tying or go ahead goal.
Right.
In the final, like, that's. Right.
Well, there's been a lot of games where.
That's why that stat is like, you got to kind of parse it a little bit.
Well, remember early in the year, they would give up a goal and the game would be tied and then go to overtime and then they would win, right? Or you know, if you go on to win, then that stat looks fine, but you still gave up the lead and it went to overtime.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have a lot of confidence when the other team has the goalie pulled that the Leafs are going to close it down. Like, even on Saturday, you know, I was supposed to put my son to bed and I was like, oh, it's 4-2. I'll probably be ready soon. It's like, nope, they blew it. So I kind of said, like, I don't know if I'm going to be ready or not, even though they were up by 2 goals. Cause, you know, I think just watching them all year, I don't know. Like, you watching the game, were you thinking that they had that locked down when they're up by 2 goals?
No, I mean, it was 3-0, and it feels a bit like it does when they're down 3-0 or they're down late in the game. Like, you always feel like they're going to come back and score. Like, they just have this game breaking ability. That's the other thing that stands out about them all the time. And just like is continually reinforced in my mind when you see them, even against other good teams, is their game breaking ability is just like almost unmatched. You know what I mean? Like, even Carolina, like, they add Gensel, they try to get some of that. They just don't have that, like, you know, like Nylander can just break open a game. Matthews can break open a game.
Even I think the game was an example of that. Like, the Leafs didn't play great 5-on-5, but they're opportunistic and they can really burn you if you make a mistake. And Carolina made a few mistakes and all of a sudden they're down 3, right? Like, it was like, it was like 8 minutes and 20 seconds stretch. The Leafs piled up 3 goals, and even without Marner and even without Yarncroc, they're dangerous.
Yes.
That's a good segue. Bilal wants to know, where does the organization see Nick Robertson and Simon Benoit fit going forward? I mean, I would just say, I think it's still TBD where they fit. I mean, you know, it'll be interesting to see if, like, do you think Robertson's going to play a role in the playoffs here?
I mean, it'll depend on health. If everyone's healthy, I don't think he'll be in the lineup. If there are injuries, it's going to be dependent on who the injury is, just because of the role that he has to play. Like, he can, the thing is, like, he can score, but the problem is, like, when he's not scoring and, like, the defensive limitations, I just don't know if Keith is going to feel like he can trust him. Like, the amount of goals he scored and the amount of ice time that he's had is pretty impressive. But I don't know. Would you trust him in a playoff game? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, the only game he's played recently, the defensive numbers were awful, you know, and that's the number one thing for him to, I know I've heard the stories of how Nick Robertson works in the off season. Like, he's got to find a skills coach who can work on him on with defensive play. He needs to get with Daryl Belfry or Adam Oates or one of these guys and just find a way to be better when he doesn't have the puck. Cause right now, like, is it just his skating is going to limit him in that regard?
And his size, like, he loses puck battles along the wall. He doesn't get pucks out. Like, it's just like,
but there's some small guys who are good at puck battles. Like, it's, you know, some of it's like smarts and positioning. It's not all how big you are. If it was, I would be the dream player in the beer league.
Yeah, that's true. It's harder though. Like, it's just I think of like a guy who's basically his size on the Leafs, like Max Domi and him are basically the same size, and it's hard for him too. Like,
Marner's not a big guy, and like, he wins like battles all the time.
Yeah, but he's like like you mentioned, his instincts are amazing. He has a great stick. He's a really good defensive player. He's also not as small as you think. Like, I'm going to pull up what he's listed at. What do you think he's listed at? He's bigger than you think.
6 feet?
6 feet, 180. Yeah, you're right. He's not that much big. He's not. Yeah, you're right. Good call. Robertson is 5'9", 178.
Yeah, there's a pretty big difference between 5'9 and 6 feet.
Yeah.
5'9's hard. 5'9 is, and not a great skater, is like, there's not a lot of guys that.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, Mark Recchi's my guy. He's one, but there's not that many players that have had big careers when that's, especially in this era. So
that's the one thing, like, we're going to talk about some of the new guys, and we mentioned Edmondson. That's the only thing with Dewar. Like, he's not big either. Like, he's 5'10", 183.
Oh, no.
He's really small.
Dewar's fine for, like, a fourth line guy. I mean, that's what I see so far from him. Energy, can play center. He's relatively young. He's RFA. You know, I don't, from what you've, like, that Kampf contract feels like a mistake, because I feel like someone like Dewar might even be able to replace his minutes if there was a way to not have Kampf anymore.
Yeah, but the only thing is, like, Kampf is big. Like, and Kampf is really good defensively in combination with being big. Like, if Kampf was making 1.5 like he was the previous two seasons, that's fine.
Is he really good defensively though? Because, like, if you look at, like, his all the numbers on him are brutal this year.
Yeah, I think he is, and he's a good penalty
killer. Spending ton of time in the
corner. A bad penalty kill. Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's some ammunition against it for sure. He's just making much for what he is.
We didn't get to it, but he also wanted to know about Simon Benoit's fit going forward. I would say so far, it doesn't look like the worst decision to bring in Edmondson, and that means Benoit is sitting. And then if someone gets hurt, he's like the next man up kind of thing.
I feel for him, James. Like, I'm not as big a fan, I think, as some people, but he's had, like, he did everything he possibly could, and then he's just gone. And now you wonder, like, what does that do for his confidence? Like, if he does get back in, it's like, oh man, like, they thought this guy was better than me. They obviously didn't believe in me as much as I had hoped. I don't know, like, that. I get it.
Yeah. I wonder what they said to him. I mean, maybe they just said, like, we're trying to win the Stanley Cup and, like, we're bringing in experience and you're going to get an opportunity. It's my concern when they brought in Edmondson and Lyubushkin, I was like, oh, Liljegren's coming out for sure. And that hasn't been the case. And Liljegren's looked good with Edmondson. Like, I think there's something there that works.
Yeah. I mean, it was fair to assume that, because that's literally what happened in previous seasons. They got other defensemen and he fell out of the lineup. He stopped playing.
But then you're going to have, you know, it's they need guys that can move the puck. You know, They need a confident Logren who can make plays up the ice, which is what we've seen a little bit recently.
It's on the table. Like, I do not think he is locked in by any means.
No, but I think that while Keefe is playing around with his roster and trying to figure out what he wants to do for the playoffs, this is Logren's opportunity to show that he can do that.
Yes. Yeah, but like, it can change really quick. Like, I'm looking at the game sheets from last year. He was playing down the stretch. Like, he was scratched a bit down the stretch, but he was playing in those final few games. And then game one, he just doesn't play. Game two, he doesn't play. You know, game three, he doesn't play. Game four, he doesn't play. Game five, he doesn't play. He finally gets into game six. Like, anyway, we'll see. Like, he has to continue to play well, I think, to keep his spot and play well once the playoffs start. Like, that's been his challenge. Like, when it gets harder, he just hasn't really been able to find that extra, like, F you, I think.
Yeah. He has a hard time with confidence and with focus.
Yeah. You know,
which are tough things for an NHL defenseman, given how fast everything moves.
Yeah.
Jeff has a question that might take too long for us to answer, so I'm going to abbreviate it. He says, place some early odds on the Leafs extending the following players. Bertuzzi. I can't see any world where he's back. He's going to want term in a big contract as a UFA. And there's not, I haven't looked that closely at the winger market in free agency, but you're not going to, I mean, we'll see how the playoffs go, I guess. I mean, if they have a really deep playoff run, then maybe that changes. But the other one he asks about is Domi, who's the same situation. He's going to want, those guys aren't going to want 1-year deals again, you know? So they're going to want term, and they're not at the age in their careers where, now, maybe you get to July 1 and they don't sign and then there's a circle back that happens. But I think if you brought Bertuzzi back, you would want him at a lower cap hit. Would you want Domi back at $3 million again? No. Probably not, right? It just he doesn't really fit with what they've got. He also asks about potentially bringing back Brody or Edmondson or Lyubushkin. It's a bit early to know.
TBD, yeah, on all of them.
I want, like, Brody, it's like, I mean, maybe he would take, like, a Giordano kind of contract to stay. You know, I know he's from the area and he's got a
They're going to have a Giordano slot to fill because he's up at the end of the year as well.
I also think that if Brody was on your third pair, that he would look a lot better than he has lately.
Yeah, you it's know, just asking too much of him at this point in his career.
You know, if you can sign him for 2 years at $1.5 million and he plays in your third pair, I think you're in a good spot. So anyway, but probably too. I don't know if you know have heard anything about this, but I mean, there's lots of talk that, you know, Tree Living tried to trade Brody in the past, and then maybe he's down on Brody, and so, you know, Brody's not a big guy. He doesn't exactly fit the mold of what Tree Living is trying to do on the back end, so that might be part of him not being back as well. All right, Torin wants to know, in the off season, are there realistic targets for the Leafs to finally get their white whale? You know what their white whale is, Jonas?
Is that a right D who can?
Yes.
Is that, yes, TJ? Isn't that TJ Brody? Like, once upon a time, it was.
Well, I don't know if he was like a gray whale or something. Okay. He was. Whether it's a number one or two partner for Riley or driving a matchup pair, it seems like that's a roster piece we sorely need. I've looked at the UFA class for defensemen, and there's not a lot there that excites me. There were only nine, last I looked, there were only nine defensemen who have played 20 plus minutes a game in that class. One of them is John Klingberg, and another one is TJ Brody. So seven others that have played 20 minutes a game this year that are UFA defensemen in July. So there's a couple okay options, but it feels like trade is probably how they're going to have to address that need.
Yeah, like it, Hanifin would have helped, and obviously he's not a right D, but he's not signing here. Gustav Forsling would have been a nice fit. He re-signed. There's just not a ton. Like, maybe Brady Shea, he's a lefty. Dylan DeMello, right D, but like, he's okay. Yeah, it's not, I think you're right. I think it's trade. And then the question is, like, what do you trade? But anyway, that's for another off-season podcast.
Okay. lightning round, two more here. We'll do it real quick. Corey wants to know, if you had to place a bet right now, who would you say starts game one of the playoffs?
Samsonov.
Yeah, me you? Too. Yeah, me too. Yep. And AJ wants to know, who would you rather see the Leafs face in round one, Florida or Boston? What's the better matchup for them?
I would say Boston.
That's a hard one.
Yeah, I don't think it's, neither one is easy, but if you have to pick.
Yeah, I kind of lean Florida just because there's something about Boston and playing there that, like, just the Leafs don't seem to be able to figure it out. Such a hostile environment. But Florida's such a good team. And I think that series last year was closer than the way people talk about it against the Panthers. And
it was, for sure. Yeah, it was. Like, it was
five games, but it was three of the games were toss-ups.
Well, and you just can't imagine their two highest paid players not scoring. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that doesn't feel likely to repeat itself. I mean, obviously their playoff history is well documented. But that was a huge part of the series. Like, you're right. Like, those first couple games were close.
Yeah. So I'm going to say, just to be different, I'm going to say Florida. You said Boston. I don't know about you. I'm really looking forward to the first round of the playoffs. Like, I think it's going to be very, very interesting. And you look at I was talking to CJ the other day, and he said he thinks that some people are sleeping on the Leafs and, like, writing them off too much. Do you know, I looked this up, since mid-November, do you know where the Leafs rank in the NHL in terms of their record?
I know it's top five.
Yeah, they had the fourth best record in the league. And that's since Klingberg came out of the lineup, you know. And I think that there's a bit of correlation there. Like, they've won a lot of games recently, and their record is, what are they, 16-3-1 or something like that in the last 20? It's pretty good. So I think,
yeah,
that
but
anyone,
you know what,
anyone writing them, anyone yeah, writing but, them off and saying they don't have a chance, I don't, they're not watching the same games that I have.
But. Yeah, that's why I always found the conversation, like, about them, and it's like, well, they don't have enough, and, like, they can't beat Florida. And then you ask them, and it's like, well, how would you pick a Florida Toronto series? And they're like, probably Florida in seven. And I'm like, well, then you're saying, like, it's like basically a toss up series that they can win. But yeah, I mean, I guess the only thing to your point, to counter your point, is, yes, they're like fourth or whatever in the NHL since then, but Florida and Boston both have better records this season. So, like, and those are the teams they're going to play. So,
no, I'm not. They definitely don't have an easy path, but I also think that the Leafs aren't as good as they've been the last couple of years in the regular season. There's been a step back, but it's a small step back. It's not a huge one.
I think we'll be back next Wednesday, I believe. We haven't discussed that, but I think that makes sense. The Leafs play, they've got a back-to-back this week, Philadelphia, Washington, and then another back-to-back, James, a home and a road back-to-back, Edmonton and Carolina. That is a really tough back-to-back. And then they've got Jersey on the following Tuesday.
They've got to go to Carolina on Sunday on the road after playing. Yeah, that's...
And it's a 6 o'clock start. That's a tough one.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Such is life in the NHL.
I think they should cut the schedule down to 72, 75 games a year and not have any back-to-backs anymore. I think they should only be able to have back-to-backs if the team is in the same spot for both the games. I think,
like,
that's a
home back-to-back. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that should be the only way they do it. Cause when you watch them travel, like, we see them when you're there covering a game, a home game, and they've got a road game the next day, it is a mad scramble for them to get to the airport, like, as soon as the game ends. Like,
I have done it, James, with them. And obviously I was not playing. The way your body feels the next day is just, and that's not playing. It's brutal. Like, it's really hard on your body. You get in really late.
You get into the plane mini bar every time, though. That's why you feel like that.
Yeah. You know me. All right, James. Well, thank you to everybody for listening. Thanks to Punch, our producer. We'll talk next week. Goodbye.